Welcome to the Johan René podcast, where we dabble in philosophy, sample a little culture, perform some politics, grapple with history, and make the dip into religion. With me, your gezonde Dutch host, Johan René Schaper. Okay, welcome to the Johan René podcast. I am your host, Johan René Schaper, and today I am joined by Rabbi Pesach Sommer, who is a teacher and a public speaker. And we're going to talk today about personal struggles in Emunah. I heard Rabbi Pesach speak about this several times, and I was very impressed about his honesty and about his own struggles and his experiences with others. So I figured he would be a great person to ask on the show. Rabbi Sommer, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. Please call me Pesach.
Okay, Pesach. So, personal struggles with faith. Let's just get straight into it. Like, you were born religious, right?
Yes.
Oh, how do you call it? Firm from birth. So,
loosely defined, yes. I mean, I was born into a, Shomer Shabbos family, although that grew over time. We kept, kosher. But I was not a very... It was not a house where we were particularly different from the average modern Orthodox family of the time. Torah study was not something that happened other than in school. I don't think knew a lot about Shabbat beyond the obvious things, about Shabbos beyond the obvious, don't use electricity, don't use cars, don't, drive that kind of thing. We kept kosher, although we would, rely on the most lenient interpretation, and things like that. But yeah, loosely defined modern Orthodox of the 70s and 80s.
Right. Well, I'm not American, so I don't really have a context for that other than stories. But so you became more religious later in life? You became ultra-Orthodox, or how do you identify?
That's the thing. I followed that trajectory through high school, even through, I spent a year in Israel, supposedly to be studying in yeshiva, more often, hanging out with friends on Ben Yehuda. I think nothing really drew me towards that world, other than summers and camp, where I a little bit was drawn towards, I had some spiritual yearnings that I discovered. But it was only due to the fact that my friends got more into it, and I sort of kind of went with it without having that real, sense of why. And only within, the early years of my marriage did I really, really pick up in terms of a more serious commitment.
Okay. Would you say that when you were younger, you just assumed the religion was true, or you didn't even ask those questions? Was there something you did?
I don't think I thought about it too deeply. I mean, I think, once in a while I would, kind of have that typical, teenage angsty kind of, I don't know if God is true, but I certainly was not someone who, beyond arguing with, a friend or a counselor in camp or something like that, I was certainly not going to crack open any books or speak to any rabbis or try to do anything, do any serious lifting.
So what changed internally? Not, I understand your friends, pulled you into it a little bit, but what changed internally that you felt I should be more committed to this?
I think partially, I think once I married someone who was as committed as my wife is, it was the right path to be on. Again, a lot of my friends were there. And I think that, and maybe we'll get into this a little bit later, but I think to some degree, unless you're a deeply philosophical person or a person who's really thinking in that vein, the more Jewish you live, the more Jewish you believe. And so I kind of was more on the team, became more committed to what was going on. Although again, without a strong background in learning and without really, without even a sense of where I was going to go with it, but just, you're going to keep Shabbos, may as well keep it as more seriously. If you're going to, if you're going to have friends who learn Torah, then you should be learning. But certainly the early years of marriage, certainly at least that first year, it was still developing, I think, internally.
Right. I think that's very different between me as a convert who of course came to the religion as an adult, and it was, I like to say it was intellectual, but we don't know what subconsciously played there, of course. But like, I was much more intellectually oriented, and I didn't have any background or any assumptions when I joined the clan as a young adult. So I want to know. So you personally went to a struggle of faith, if I understand correctly, right?
Yes. Later. Yes, much later.
Could you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the thing. Like, I sort of, you know, it's interesting. I mentioned, you know, the first we were married, we were living in New York, living in Washington Heights. I was planning on going to social work or counseling or something of that sort. And little by little, as I studied, I mean, I actually was in school for social work for the better part of a year. And little by little, I realized I wanted to work with kids. I'd worked with NCSY, you know, so I kind of felt a little bit drawn towards maybe Kiruv, Chinuch, but again, I didn't have smicha. I could not learn Gemara at that point. And I sort of fell into a combination NCSY teaching job out in Ohio. And before you knew it, I was in the world of Chinuch. You know, again, you know, and if you're living in a small out-of-town community, you know, being Shomer Shabbos, being, you know, knowing some Hebrew, being able to learn a little Chumash, you know, forget, you know, you don't have to know Gemara. I mean, and so I sort of fell into teaching, discovered that I really, really liked it. My wife and I ended up making Aliyah, going to Israel for a couple of years, because, you know, if I was really going to continue with Chinuch beyond, you know, small town USA, I was, you know, I really, that I had to learn more. And again, I began, what's turned into a long career in Chinuch. And at some point, I don't know, I'm guessing maybe about 8-9 years ago, you know, little by little, due to various things, I had become much more intellectual in my Judaism, much more philosophical. And, you know, I was already serving as sort of that teacher where the kids could ask, you know, their serious questions to. But little by little, as I read more and as I thought more, little things started to bother me. In other words, I always say it wasn't, you know, one particular thing. It was sort of, you know, death by a thousand paper cuts. And little by little, I started to wonder whether I really believed anymore. And, you know, during that time I was still teaching, you would find me in the classroom talking about what Chazal believed, because I could no longer talk about what I believed, because I really didn't know. And when it basically didn't work for me to stay in that job at the end of the year, I decided to take a break from Chinuch, because I felt like I couldn't continue. And at that point, it was a very, very difficult stretch trying to figure out what, if anything, I still believed.
Did you have kids at the time?
Yes. Yeah. That certainly made things much more complicated, right? I mean, I not only was married, but I had, and you know, now we have, thank God, 8 children. I think we either had 6 or 7 when this started. That was the thing. I mean, I decided very early on that no matter what I ended up deciding in terms of faith, I did not feel that it was reasonable for me to try to bring the family with me, or even to try to work out some sort of system where, you know, they would stay from and I would not. I felt like I had signed on the dotted line. I was way past my time to, you know, figure out my life. And if, you know, my wife and kids needed me to be, you know, Orthodox, I was going to be Orthodox.
Right. I met people who consciously choose to become orthoprax, where, you know, you don't believe orthodoxy, but you still practice the orthodox way. And that's their solution to that. But right,
I'm sorry. Yeah, that's what I was planning. I mean, that's what I was going to do. Well, you know, again, you know, I don't know. I don't know where it would have gone. I mean, it's an interesting question. You know, what would I have done in private? What would I have done when I was alone? I don't know. But certainly, you know, for all intents and purposes, I was planning on continuing to live the way that I'd been living.
Right. That is. I also said this once to my wife. I said, if I would ever lose my faith, God forbid, I'd be orthoprax. You know, unless I convert to unless I come to accept Yoski in my heart or something, right? Chas v'shalom. So yeah. Then I guess you have to act upon. But there's really no reason, like, to be secular. You know, if you have this life, it's not a terrible lifestyle. So even if you don't fully believe it or don't believe it, one can still live it, and especially if you're raised with it, I guess. So right, orthoprax always seems like an idea.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's, you know, first of all, you know, I mean, that's the thing. Even when I wasn't sure what I believed, I very much respected my wife's faith. And I certainly didn't want to damage it. You know, I mean, I certainly did not, you know, I mean, I know people now who, as they lost faith, they kind of brought their spouse with them. And I never wanted to do that. I didn't even want her to know that I was struggling. Of course, you know, you and I both know that you don't keep something like that, you know, no matter how quiet you try to be, you know, wives are much smarter than we, than we are. And also, yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I did like the lifestyle. I certainly believe that, what my kids were getting in from schools was much more aligned with how I'd want them to live than what they'd be getting in a public school.
Right. I hear that. So did you talk to anyone about it?
I try to talk to pretty much anyone and everyone. You know, I mean, I'll, you know, just some examples. Well, again, just even before I started talking, I was sort of from that, you know, kind of obnoxious, you know, semi-intellectual YU world where I thought, like, you know, the sun, you know, rose and set on the YU empire. And so I figured that, you know, between, you know, Rabbi Lam, Rav Soloveitchik, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, I just had to find the right book. And they, of course, had all the answers and I would read it and all my questions would go away. And of course, no such thing exists. And, you know, so little by little, I started talking to people. Among the people I spoke with, Dr. Alan Brill was very, very helpful. Rabbi Jeremy Weider, you know, Rosh Yeshiva at YU. You know, as you know, I used to be a very serious marathon runner. Rabbi Weider, I think, still runs. And I used to go for these long runs with him. I used to call it, you know, instead of born to run, born to rev. And we'd go for these, you know, 2-hour runs. And I would just sort of fire all my questions at him. Rabbi Yisachar Katz from Chovve was helpful. But pretty much right. Anyone, you know, anyone who I could meet who, you know, just seemed like an interesting thinking person, I was willing to engage with. It didn't have to be a professor or a rabbi. It was, you know, I mean, peers who I thought who could handle it and who had what to say. And I also became a very voracious reader. I mean, I was always a big reader. My family growing up, I mean, you know, my father was an avid reader and books were capital in my house, but I was not generally, you know, Jewish or philosophical stuff. You know, at this point, I just started reading anything I could get my hands on. Eliezer Berkowitz, Rabbi Eliezer Berkowitz, Heschel, academic stuff. I mean, pretty much anything.
Right. Well, you were lucky in the sense that you had genuine intellectuals like Dr. Alan Brill. He is a great scholar. And of course, Rabbi Jeremy Weider is a very great scholar. So who could relate to intellectual questions and could operate on that level themselves intellectually. I think most people, when they go to these struggles, they don't have that, right? They look at the Kiruv Rabbi, the Outreach Rabbi, the little tract put out, some Eisha Torah article, right? Which wouldn't satisfy a genuine intellectual person, I would argue.
Yeah, I mean, I'm one of the admins in a Facebook group from OTD Dialogue, and that's one of the things that gets me every single time when a yeshivish person talks about their struggles and they talk about how they went to speak to some, you know, Kiruv Rabbi, and I just every single time I just want to say, like, no, that's not who you want to speak to if you're having this intellectual, you know, I mean. Look, I was definitely fortunate that I was able to reach out to them. But I think some of it is just knowing that you know, we're living in a good time for this. In other words, I think pre-internet sort of, yeah, you know, I do know some intellectual people in my life and I would have probably, you know, maybe been able to reach out to them. But one of the things I discovered along the line is that most thinking Jews of all stripes, you know, I mean, across the board, you know, and you know, really of all stripes, if you reach out to them with genuine questions and with genuine interest and show that you're not there to try to fight, but really you just try to learn, people are really open. And that's one of the things I would really encourage people to realize is that, you know, even if you don't, I don't think I'd ever met Dr. Brill before. No, I certainly hadn't met him. I mean, I read some of his stuff, of course, but in general, you know, especially those who are on Facebook, but if not through email, I mean, there's so many people who I've gotten to know. You know, big Talmidei Chachamim, serious academics, Jewish and not, people are really accessible. And again, you know, you're only as limited as your kind of your guts or your willingness to reach out to interesting thinking people. So, you know, if you know that there are rabbis out there, if you know that there are academics out there who you think, wow, they could really be helpful to me, I would encourage you to reach out. I found really without with no exceptions that people were really willing to give their time and thoughts and very, very helpful.
Yeah, I was lucky enough when I was converting to Judaism. So I didn't have an emotional or an emunah struggle because I didn't have any emunah. I was just exploring it. But when I was in the process of exploring and thinking about conversion to Judaism, the internet just had hit it bigger. Like it was in the early 2000s. So there was resources there. And I remember a Muslim friend of mine. I grew up in the Netherlands, but I grew up in Zaandam, which has the largest Turkish Muslim community in Western Europe, I think. Definitely had the largest mosque until Germany recently had a bigger one. So a lot of my friends were Muslims, and they gave me a thing from the internet that had the Talmudic quotes on it. I'm sure you've seen them go around that were really like bigoted and terrible, like the Talmud must be like this evil book. But luckily I had the internet, so I found Rabbi Gil's student little website that dealt with questions in the Talmud, right? And this is not on an academic level, right? Because I am new to this. I don't know the Talmud. I don't know academic Talmud or anything. So, but because I had the internet, I could just see these rabbis' responses to this claim, and it gave me context. And actually, recently, I sent that very same outdated website to a Southern Baptist friend of mine who had someone asking him the same questions in his church about Jews and about the Talmud. So the internet is a great resource. And now, of course, if you are genuinely want intellectual, there's so many blogs and interesting things and interesting debates. I think people often think the internet is going to damage people's emunah, but I think it can also save people's emunah.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think it depends who you are. It depends what you're looking for. Again, you know, that's the thing. I think, you know, kind of if you've never been exposed to questions, 5 minutes on the internet and you're going to just, you're going to be exposed to every, you know, question, every challenge that's out there. But if you're someone who's already, you know, searching, if you're someone who's already not sure, there's just a tremendous wealth of stuff that's out there, blogs and Facebook groups and just, again, there's a lot of smart people out there. I mean, you know, as I said, you know, while it's true that there is no, you know, there's no book you're going to read that are going to just put all your questions to sleep, but you are going to find a lot of deep thinking people who are intellectual, who are sophisticated, and who are, you know, living lives of faith. And again, as I said, you know, assuming that these are people who are, you know, alive still, obviously, if you're reading older books, that's not going to be the case. But if it's, you know, these are people who will respond. I mean, again, I've made many friendships where we were friends virtually before we were friends in real life.
Yeah, I have over the years collected a lot of academics and scholars in many different fields. Some not even Jewish, but just because the internet allowed me to reach out to people. Here's my question. What particular issues did you struggle with personally when you went through that crisis?
I definitely think, biblical criticism was part of it. You know, in other words, I don't think it was so much, is there a God, as much as, you know, even if there's a God, you know, is Judaism true? Is the Torah from God? At the time, I was living with the standard Orthodox belief that in order to get to God, you had to get to Torah. You had to go through Torah. And if Torah in any way was not, you know, kind of the word for word, letter for letter, exactly from God, well, then, you know, what does that even mean about your relationship with God? Subsequently, I sort of moved away from that formulation, which I think is actually sort of a broken one. But that was probably the biggest thing. But again, you know, all sorts of questions, historical truths, you know, that Judaism claimed, you know, even something as simple. And again, it's not, you know, simple, but it's not, you know, it's not one of the Yud Gimel Ikrim, but, you know, was the Hanukkah story, you know, beyond the battle with the Greeks, was the, you know, miracle of the oil true, or things like that? It was just, you know, as I said, it was not, you know, one big thing, but it was just a lot of, it was just, you know, as I said, you know, death by 1,000 paper cuts.
Right. I also, I feel personally that a lot of times people, because they don't have a historical background, meaning they don't know how the historical method worked, they get a lot of, like, I remember sitting in yeshiva and there was a midrash, I forgot what it was, and it sounded really ahistorical. And the person I was learning with was really going through some struggles there because it sounded not reasonable to him. And I'm like thinking, this is a 5th century text, like of people with different opinions. This is not like, even if, right, like the Torah Shebaal Peh comes from Har Sinai, right? Even if you accept that all the halachas, every detail comes from our Sinai, the most large view you can have there, then still individual stories of Rabbah Bar Chana meeting a giant fish, that doesn't come from our Sinai. So I couldn't relate to that, but I realized because people are trained to think about these texts as sort of the divinely inspired and everything mentioned in it, even if it's an opposing opinion or it's all that is all tested by some Ruach HaKodesh, I guess, some spirit.
Yeah, I remember one of the most helpful things that Rabbi Weider told me. I remember he said, Pesach, you have to take all your beliefs sort of like off the shelf one by one and ask yourself, and discover whether or not you think they're true. And even if they're not true, is that a problem? In other words, right, that's the thing. In other words, like I was sort of like looking for the maximalist position that sort of like everything that I had always thought had to hold up. And if it didn't, then the whole system was going to just fall apart. And what he was saying to me was that, in terms of, there are a lot of things that are, that are not, again, obviously I'm using Yud Gimli Karim in the, just as like as an example. I don't, think that that's really the be all and the end all, but, in other words, there's all sorts of, in other words, whether or not, the Nes, the Pach HaShemen happened or didn't happen, your Judaism does not, rise or fall on that. In other words, you could, you could in theory still keep, observe the, Hanukkah, think of it more in terms of like, the story is more agadic in terms of adding to the miracle, or you could be much more sophisticated in that. And again, it wouldn't damage in the slightest. And that really kind of, that was really permission that I got to like, whoa, okay, wait a second. I know, like I sort of thought like you were basically either all in or all out. Now I have to kind of figure out, now I have to come to something much more nuanced.
Right. There's like a basic web of belief. And at the center is like God and revelation and that God has a relationship with the world, right? And then like on the outside of the web are these extra things that if you remove them or if they get questioned, the whole web doesn't fall apart. Like I said to a friend of mine, he'll have an emunah problem and about some small issue. And then I asked him, so does this mean God didn't create the universe that leads you? It's like, no, right? And then you build it up. It's like, well, does this mean that the Torah is completely nonsense? He's like, no. I said, so you already basically have the basics of your religion. Like, so you're just asking a quite interesting question on the detail. Just be excited about the question. Just explore it. Like, why this emotional crisis? But I think it probably has to do how the way how people teach emunah in yeshivas.
Right. So I don't think it's about how they teach emunah because they don't. I mean, that's the simple truth. They just sort of, they create.
Well, maybe that's the problem.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's certainly something that I've tried to work on in terms of my own, teaching. But, I mean, particularly in the Haredi world, in other words, again, coming back to that group from OTD Dialogue, there's certain, there's often, particularly with those from the Haredi world, there's often the sense that, in order to save their faith, you have to be able to convince them that everything they ever learned in yeshiva must be true. And, in other words, which is just like with all due respect, it's an absurd starting point because, in other words, the Haredi world, again, like they sort of throw an entire system at you. And I always say it's like a great system unless you need it to be historically accurate. But that's the thing. In other words, like if the only way your Judaism can survive can be to believe that, I don't know, that the Chasam Sofer had Ruach HaKodesh or that Moshe Rabbeinu was really 10 amos tall or whatever. I mean, or that the world is only 5,700 plus years old. So then you're sunk because, but if you're willing to say, wait a second, the approach that I was given didn't work. It's sort of coming back to the idea of like a second naivety. In other words, once you, what you had falls away, you're almost certainly not going back to it. And so if the only way you can go back is to have exactly what you used to have and just everything is going to go away and everything is going to feel the way it did and I'm going to feel all secure and I'm still going to be able to be Haredi and still going to be able to, you're pretty much finished. But if you're willing to say like, okay, you know what? I got a very narrow approach. And maybe it was not a particularly intellectual approach. And yes, they never really taught me any of this stuff. And now I have to sort of rebuild from scratch. There's a lot out there. It's just not going to get you back to your previous state.
Right. If you are in Lakewood Yeshiva, in a hardcore Litvisha Yeshivisha place, and you have the beliefs of the Rambam, they would not consider that Haredi beliefs, if you just have discovered the Rambam. But they would consider the Rambam himself a kosher yid. So if someone comes from a Haredi system, you know, and they can see that, like, yeah, not everyone that is considered a kosher yid had the beliefs of that system that you grew up in. You know, they know that. They learn the Rambam. They learn he's a Das Yachid or something. But they know that there's people out there that don't have the exact same beliefs in the past that are still considered great people by their own movement. So they can see that there is something more basic to Judaism or Yiddishkeit than this whole giant web of all the details of doctrines that they were taught.
I mean, yes and no. I mean, that's, you know, they know about the Rambam, but what does that mean that they know about the Rambam? Certainly, they've never learned Mora Nevuchim, and if it's referred to at all, in other words, you know, like the, you know, the standard joke, you know, that, you know, why is he called Maimonides? Because everyone has my version of what he is, you know, and like the academics think the Mora is the real thing and the Mishnah Torah is just for those, you know, like Nebuch from Jews. But the, you know, the yeshivish position is the exact opposite, that the Mishnah Torah is the real Rambam and the Mora Nevuchim was just for those, you know, kind of messed up, you know, so. They may know it exists. They've certainly not learned it. And again, like that's, you know, it's so, to me, it's like so wacky because, yeah, you know, like they hold by his Yud Gomili Karim, but his whole Yud Gomili Karim are based on a view of what Olam Haba is, that if you said it in a yeshiva, you'd get smacked in the face. I mean, it's, you know, in other words, like that's, they have a very, very narrow view of the Rambam to the point where, yeah, I mean, the Mora Nevuchim, maybe they know it exists, but they certainly don't know what it says. And they, you know, in other words, so, yeah, I mean, that's the thing. So, you know, can you get back to the yeshivish, you know, Rambam, who really was just, you know, maybe Nebuchy was Sparty, but he basically was really one of us, you know, not really. I mean, because, you know, that Rambam didn't really ever exist in the first place. So, again, you know, that's right. The thing. They really, they have been exposed, you know, they've heard of the Rambam, but again, but it's not the Rambam that you and I know.
Right, they have a caricature of the Rambam almost. So, how did you start climbing out of this? And I know you found some particular swarm and thinkers that really helped you, and that are still helping you with your spirituality. How did you climb out of this hole eventually?
So yeah, personally? I mean, so that's the thing. I mean, as I mentioned, I mean, I was just talking with whoever I could, and I was reading whatever I could, and. You know, often, you know, again, I'd be reading one thing and, you know, maybe it worked for me or it didn't work for me, but there would be a footnote in there. I'd be like, oh, this is interesting. Let me see if anybody knows about him. And then, you know, little by little. And I remember one day I was reading this book. It was a collection of essays. I think it was edited by Rabbi Art Green, who's not Orthodox, but who is, to me, is just a fascinating person. And somewhere in the back, I think he mentioned Hillel Zeitlin, who I'd never heard of. And again, one thing led to another, and ends up that Art Green also edited. I think the only, published English translation of Hillel Zeitlin, at least as far as I'm aware of, was put together by Art Green, and I ordered it, and it blew me away. It really, that wasn't the start of it. I mean, again, I had already sort of sensed that my pre-struggle, you know, rationalist approach with a little bit of like yeshivish leaning. I was not going to come back. I was not going to get to come back to. I was definitely discovering an inner world that I had never really paid attention to before. But more than anyone, Hillel Zeitlin was really the one who was just. It was just this eureka moment because, you know, to me, you know, I mean, little by little, I had never heard of him. I literally had never heard of him. And little by little, as I moved on, I mean, I realized that a lot of people in Israel actually discuss him. A whole world in Israel, which I had never had access to, you know, so I didn't know about it here. And in America, pretty much no one seemed to know about him.
Could you give a short historical context who he was and where his thought fits into Yiddishkeit?
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. I think he's so incredibly helpful because, again, I mean, he's born into a Frum family. He's born into a Chabad family, if not exactly a Lubavitch family. And he's, you know, it's kind of one of these like typical sounding stories. I mean, he was a genius and he was kind of an Eloy. And I don't know how, but at some point in his teens, he, you know, became aware of biblical criticism and decided that he was going to slay the beast. And as so often happens to so many people, the reverse happened. It really sort of beat him up. And he was living, you know, he had this whole group of friends, you know, some of whom ended up becoming famous in various ways, great Hebrew writers and things like that. And again, he was part of this whole group of people who were very philosophically inclined. You know, they were reading Russian literature, Dostoevsky and things like that. And they were all sorts of philosophy, you know, Jewish, not Jewish. And again, he's this brilliant guy, and he's reading everything. I mean, and you know Spinoza and Nietzsche and all sorts of people. And again, he was even he did not completely abandon religion as he went through these struggles. In fact, he was known as like the kofer with tefillin. You know that he still he was a kofer. He didn't properly believe, but he was still putting on his tefillin, unlike some of his friends who left. And he did really, really heavy lifting, really hard work, trying to work his way back. And again, he was, he was a writer. He was not a, he wrote for newspapers. He wrote in magazines, a lot of these Jewish journals, which existed at the time. He was living in Poland. And, he worked on it a lot. I mean, he really just, he was very, very open about what his struggles were, where he fell, what the big questions were. And little by little, he started coming back to the world of Hasidus. He wrote about, he wrote several books on Rabbi Nachman, but one of them, the first decade of the 1900s, he wrote his more of like a neo-romantic sort of view of Rabbi Nachman. But little by little, he sort of rebuilt his faith, to the point where by the 19, World War One really, had a big effect on him, religious Zionism. But after World War One already, he had already returned to observance, and he continued to write for the rest of his life. And again, he was writing in these Yiddish newspapers and journals, and all of this is out there. Again, not in English. Other than Art Green's book, it's not in English. There's a lot in Hebrew. There's a lot in Yiddish, which unfortunately is off limits to me. But there's been a tremendous amount that was published initially or that's been republished. Now there's a number of people who are working on republishing things. And here's a guy who spells it all out. Here's where I fell. Here's where I worked. Here's how I got back. And it's like, wow. In other words, because who writes about this? In other words, how many, someone once said to me, she didn't quite call me Harry Potter, but you're the one who lived, most people, they start going down this rabbit hole. They don't come back. And so, I don't know. It's an interesting question. The people who lost their belief or who struggled, we generally don't know about it. In other words, I think I can say this. Well, I'm going to say it. So I guess I can say it. But, I have it on very good authority from someone that Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg went through a religious struggle. But the Rosh Yeshiva of Ner Yisrael. And whatever it is, and whatever his questions were, and however he made his way back, we're never going to know about it because he couldn't talk about it publicly. Meaning that, in other words, there are obviously much bigger people than me who went through these struggles and, managed to come back. But generally, if they were from the firm world, they were not really allowed to acknowledge that they were going through the struggles. They were not able to talk about the big questions. And here's Hillel Zeilen, who, again, is a world-class, scholar, a genius. It's kind of ironic. He was writing in the popular press, but he was, he was a world-class thinker, and again, completely self-taught. And here's this guy again, who basically, not that his path is going to be everybody's, but he really shows a willingness to engage with all these different things. And all these people have these questions, and most of them have never even heard of him, which to me is tragic. And I've tried as much as I can from my little perch over here to try to spread the gospel.
Well, you're the first one to introduce him to me, and then that stayed with that. I never really delved into that. It's always on my list to look into him, but it never happened. So his approach, he comes back to Hasidus after this. Like many people, including myself, would be surprised by that. Hasidus, not on a spiritual level, that I understand, but sort of on a haskafic level, that seems to be hard for me. Does he come back haskafically or existentially?
Yeah, I don't know exactly. He became much, much more into Kabbalah. In fact, there's a beautiful story, although there's several different versions. But when he was actually, he was in the Warsaw Ghetto, and he was ultimately killed by the Nazis. But the popular story that exists is that when the deportation was taking place, I think in 1942, he put on his talis and tefillin, and he took his Zohar, and he walked, fully erect to where the Nazis were. And supposedly people say that even the Nazis were sort of treated him with great respect. I mean, so in other words, again, like the Zohar became, this very, very meaningful, work for him. Again, I think he has this sort of, existential approach. I don't know if that's exactly the right word, but in other words, but one of the things I think that Hasidus does, and I think this is such an important thing to think about. I mean, I recently started a chavrusa with a friend of mine in Sod Yesharim from, which is from the school of Ishbitz. And, you know, I mean, and what comes out of there, and what I think Chassid has really encouraged us to think about, is that we usually think about doubt as being an intellectual activity, something that you have to resolve intellectually, that you have these struggles and you have to sort of put it together, read this book and that book and proofs and all these kind of things. And Chassid says, no, you know, doubt is existential. It's lived. The more you live in a physical world that is devoid of any sort of spiritual existence, any godly existence, the more you're going to doubt, and the more you can sort of see this world as temporary and as not the ultimate reality, the more the doubt is going to fade away. And so, in that sense, you know, that's the thing. In other words, like, you know, he doesn't, you know, talk about, you know, proofs or anything like that. He just. You know, again, and with very sophisticated philosophy. In other words, he's not, you know, again, this is not just some sort of emotional thing, but again, he's backing it up. And he had, you know, this one particular teacher who was very influential in his life, Lev Shestov, who was a Jewish philosopher, but not a Jewish philosopher, meaning, in other words, he was one of the typical Jews of the Haskalah who had lost his faith, or maybe never had faith, but who was very, you know, very, very involved in philosophy. And Shestov played a big role in Zeitlin's life. I mean, he keeps on coming back to him throughout his writings. And one of the things that you see, but ultimately, I mean, he uses this idea of Shestov, in other words, that he talks about, you know, in peeling away layer after layer after layer after layer until you get to that, the most basic part of who you are. And what do you discover in there? In other words, again, there's nothing... You know, again, in terms of sort of like rationalist philosophy, there's none of that there. But there's this sense that there's a you that just has some sort of a, you know, conviction that you will stake your entire existence on. And, you know, and that's, I think, ultimately, you know, where he comes back to. There's just this sense that, you know, yeah, I can't prove it and I'm not going to try to prove it. But this is just, I know that this is real.
Right. So I really relate to that because, you know, I'm very abstract, but I noticed, and when people come to me with questions, because like I have sort of a reputation, and I will explain to them some reasoning or this and that, but I won't be absolutist about it, and I don't think I almost ever helped anyone with that. Like it's just too abstract. It's not personal, and it is. I don't say it like some emotional certainty. I think a lot of people, what they like about, for instance, Kiruv rabbis, is they say it with such certainty and with such passion, right? And people need the personal touch, right? So that internal, I don't know how to describe it. How do I say it? Like most of our beliefs aren't held on a high intellectual level. And most of our doubts aren't caused by high intellectual concentrations. That's what I suspect, basing from psychology. Like Jonathan Haidt writes about these things.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. I think that, you know, in other words, again, I'm not, I wouldn't compare it to what Kiruv rabbis do, because again, I don't speak within that certainty, but in other words, but I think part of it is giving person a permission to take their own conviction seriously. Meaning, in other words, that, you know, whether you go with this fact, you know, the idea that only what can be, you know, rationally demonstrated, or you go with only what could be gone through the senses, you know, in other words, I think the great tragedy that we're still in some degree living in, even with, you know, postmodernism, you know, kind of leaving its mark, you know, the great tragedy of the Enlightenment is that it basically just said, you know, that's it. You know, it's either the senses or it's logic, and anything outside of that doesn't exist. And yet, human beings are so much more complex than that. And we have all these experiences and intuition and so many of the most important things in our life, choosing a mate and where to live and careers, they're not made, you know, very few people, you know, sit there and draw a list and it's completely, you know, neutral. And we make the most important decisions in our life with intuition, with just a sense, you know, this is me. And yet suddenly within this one area, you know, like, you know, basically, you know, so many people are given the sense that, you know, no, you must be able to demonstrate it. Unless you can convince other people it's not real. And unless it's, you know, through the senses or absolute logic. And that's such a that's not human. That's, in other words, the Enlightenment made it out that everything was scientific. And again, I'm not anti-science at all. I think what science is good at is science is great at. You know, I mean, in other words, anything in terms of physical existence, science is going to talk about that. But once you get beyond that, science has nothing to say. And again, if that's the only system that you're willing to use, then I think that, you know, that you're really going to, you're not going to be able to bring this back to the lived human experience, which is not, you know, which does not live by the same rules as the physical sciences.
Right. I think a lot of people also, when they say absolute this, prove it with scientific this and that, like, they only apply that to some issues, but not to all issues. Like, for instance, there's a concept called the principle of verification that was very popular with the positivists, logical positivists of the 60s and 50s. And it basically says, if unless you can prove something scientifically, it has no meaning. But of course, that principle is mostly discussed in context, in popular culture, in context of religion. And you never see it pop up anywhere else. Because of course, it don't apply to human rights. It don't apply to your Western values. It doesn't apply to anything. So people will dial up the skepticism very high when it comes to religion, but then they don't apply that same principle to anything else. And that principle eventually collapsed in philosophy because the principle of verification itself could not be scientifically proven, so it's self-refuting. So that was the end of that. But
I mean, that's a great example.
To religion.
Right. I mean, that's a great example because if you take the things that people are, you know, passionate about in ways that are similar to religion, you know, in terms of politics and all sorts of, there's so much that, you know, there's so many animamins in that world. There's so much, you know, there's so much that's belief. You know, in other words, you know, and yes, the same way that they'll say to me, oh, well, you know, if you were born in a Muslim world, you'd be Muslim. Yeah. If you were born in China, you'd also believe, you know, very likely that it's okay to, you know, to be doing what's going on now, you know, in terms of, you know, you know, to the Ogyars and in terms of what's being done in terms of, you know, limiting families to one child. You know, yeah, I mean, all of our life is like that. So, you know, you can be totally reductionist. And then, yeah, you're right. If you do that, so then you're going to be left with nothing. I mean, you're almost like, you know, what's his name's donkey? Who's the philosopher? You know, that, you know, you put the donkey an equal distance away from two things of food and drink, and it dies because there's no logical reason to go one in one direction or the other. I forgot what it's
I said the tip of my tongue. Whatever, but yeah, I get it.
Yeah, and that's the thing, and yet people are willing. You know, again, look what's going on in the world now in terms of politics. I mean, absolute. I mean, it's so similar to religion in so many different ways in terms of, you know, again, the animamins and the Yarig Val Yavors, and if you're not on my side, you're a heretic, and I may even be willing to kill you or certainly cancel you and all these kind of things. I'm like, wait a second, what happened to that rational skepticism that unless something can be demonstrated, you know, but I mean, that's, so it's a really great point you're making. That in other words, that somehow religion gets put to a test that no other area of life is put to a test. I mean, I always say, you know, I mean, you know, how would you ever get married if you put it to such a test? I mean, you know, there's, you know, billions of women you're never going to meet, or, you know, men, or whatever, depending on what you're looking for. I mean, you know, there's, you know, your age, and you've never been to Australia. How do you know, you know, and yet people, again, you know, make one of the biggest decisions of your life without it. It's not scientific. And you know, that's the thing. In other words, I'm a very, very, very big believer. And I think Hasidus gets you there. And to this sense that, in other words, your lived life, your intuitions, your experiences, all these things are valuable. And that, you know, if you, whatever it is that you're going to search for, whatever it is that you're going to live by, it's artificial and just really absurd to cut those things off from your experience.
Right. I mean, there's so much stuff here that we could talk about. For instance, one common thing is what you said. Like, people say, oh, well, you were born Jewish. So, of course, when you get in a car accident and you pray, you say the Shema, but the Hindu would say something else, right? Like, it's, and then you found, if you survive it, oh, of course, your religious culture influences you so that you become Judaism. But maybe another religion is true, right? So Richard Dawkins likes to say, like to push that on people, saying, you know, you grew up Christian, so of course you think Christian. But if you grew up in a Hindu line, a Muslim, you would think Islam is true. But the funny thing about that is it's also self-refuting, if that's a real argument, you know, because Richard Dawkins himself is exactly, if you look at his life, when he's born, You know, he was a teenager in the 60s. So he says, when I grew up, we were sort of marginally religious, but I left religion as a teenager. Well, if you look at his life, you know, when he was growing up as a kid in the 50s, the Anglican Church was still fairly strong. And then in the 60s, it went all down. So his life path goes exactly the same as Britain's religiosity. So he's just, right, on his own logic, he's literally a product of his own culture. And that's why when he talks, when he goes, he's not so popular anymore, but when he goes to, when he speaks in England, he doesn't speak about religion. He speaks about Islam and the struggles with Islam, right? This was a big thing in 2010. But when he goes to America, he talks about Christianity. Why is he more popular about that? Because in America is now going through the same religious decline that England went through in his lifetime when he was a young man. So, like, based on your own framing, you fit in that yourself. And there's nothing wrong with that, right?
It's more than that there's nothing wrong. It's more that there's nothing wrong with that. It's that we can't escape from that. I mean, that's the thing.
We can't escape it, right?
We are who we are. And in other words, and to say, well, if you were a robot, you wouldn't, or, you know, the thing, you know, if a person came from Mars, what would they choose? Or, I mean, these things are so, and to me, these conversations are just silly because you're not. In other words, you're not a robot trying to figure out. You're a human being with, you know, all your personal experiences, and you're trying to figure out, again, should I live with this? And again, that, you know, that's of course, yeah, you're going to make every decision you're going to make about everything. And, you know, your understanding of beauty and your understanding of truth and your understanding of meaning and of politics, everything is based on who you are. So great. You know, you know, is it something that and the idea that you should try to get away from, no one tries to get away from that. Do you try to get away from that before you date? I'm going to try to, you know, go move away from all my Western biases and try, you know, and, you know, I don't know, maybe I should think about, you know, that women who, you know, how in 17th century France, you know, women who were incredibly obese, they were attractive. You know, maybe the fact that I find, you know, thin women attractive, I mean, you know, endless of ourselves, you know, you could just keep on going forever. And then, you know, again, you know, then you become, you know, again, like that donkey I said before, that, you know, just nothing will lead you towards anything. So you just sit there and die.
Right. Yeah, I agree. Like we have to accept, and I think that's a core understanding. We have to accept our own limitations as individuals and as people and as product of a society and work within that, you know, like just, that's just how it is. I think there is objective reality, and I you know, it looks that you could discover it, right? I, for instance, think there's arguments for the existence of God. They're philosophical arguments, not scientific arguments, but these are not absolute. There's questions to be asked there. It just goes by plausibility. But when I talk to other thinkers, they feel the plausible, what I think is very plausible, they feel is not so plausible. So I think, or there I see it's very tied to me individually also, how I maybe want to see things or how I just think differently. And then reading the same thing as they do, come to different conclusions.
Right. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, I think one of the things that happens, you know, in other words, like, you know, I've been in Chinuch now for about 20 years. And, you know, I you know, people also, they come to me, you know, because of the fact that, you know, because of my experience. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, I mean, I hear all the time, I remember, Rav Ozer Glickman, Zichrono Livracha, you know, that, you know, he once pointed this out. He says that, you know, because he was one of, you know, he and Rabbi Weider, Yibarol L'Chaim Tovim, that he, you know, that they were like sort of like the more intellectual Rosh Yeshiva Wayu, when parents would come to them when their kids were going through these religious struggles and ask them to basically, you know, save them or convince them. And what he pointed out was really, it's a question of where you hang your hat. In other words, once a person's on their way out, once a person feels, for whatever reason, that the world that they grew up in no longer is theirs and maybe is even bad, and they start to feel comfortable in a secular and maybe even an anti-religious world, there's nothing, right. You know, again, that's the thing. There's nothing intellectually you're going to say that's going to pull them back in. It, you know, a person hangs, they feel at home in a certain world. And a person who's, again, you know, again, like a lot of times, you know, you know, through Project Malcolm or other things, you know, Haredi people call me up. And again, it's sort of like they're so mad at religion and they're so sure that it's not true, right? And they've, you know, they've discovered Dawkins as if they've discovered America and they think they've, you know, come upon something. And it's like, what am I going to say to them at that point? In other words, you know, like, you know, because, you know, people get insulted. I mean, that's one of the questions that keeps on coming up, you know, on From OTD. You know, does anybody go off the derech for being, you know, for completely intellectual reasons? Or does anybody become a tshuva for a completely intellectual reason? Again, it comes back to what we just said before. We're not completely intellectual with anything in our existence. We are human beings who are, you know, composite of these different polls and things like that. And yeah, I mean, once you want out for whatever reason, and again, maybe even because you've had intellectual questions, everything that you're going to experience is going to be viewed through that. Going to be viewed through that lens. And, you know, again, that's right. The same argument that, you know, you and I might find compelling to a person who wants out, it's not. And that's the thing. I mean, there are no slam dunks. So now that there are not, now that there's no 100% proof of anything, so what do you do? Do you sit there and just give up? Do you, you know, or do you trust your sense of intuition? Do you trust the sense that, you know, you have to, in the end, you have to make one way or another, right? You know, to quote the nice Jewish, you know, lead singer of Rush, you know, Geddy Lee, you know, that I always get this wrong. I'm sure someone will correct me if they live. But, you know, even when you don't decide, you still have made a choice. You know, there's no such thing as staying neutral. So in the end of the day, you have to live, you have to live with it, you have to live without it, you have to be pro, you have to be, but you're going to do something. And it's not going to be completely intellectual, because you're not completely intellectual.
Right. But that's why when I phrase that, like when I say someone goes off for personal reasons or for intellectual reasons, I would phrase that as intellectual within the realm that we do, that some people are more intellectual than others, or some people go more by argument. Because I do think arguments influence us, right? But
yeah,
to what extent they influence us objectively, how much fully, I don't even know. Maybe some of my arguments are like, I'm just nailing it. I just found reality. It was awesome. But I'm like, maybe that's just subjective, right? So there is a sort of a level. It's like we're not rejecting. I certainly am not a postmodernist. I'm not rejecting objective reality, and I'm not rejecting evidence and arguments, but I'm recognizing my own limitations as a human being, because I catch myself all the time. I switched views on politics based on some argument here and there, and then, but do I master economy to the level that I really did? That really change me, or did I just like the style? You know, at what point am I objective? So we see this with everything, but I think there is a level of objectivity. We just have to recognize that we might not be, we are not fully objective, so we just have to accept that.
Yeah, and I mean, look, I want to stress very strongly, I'm not saying that I don't, you know, that everyone, you know, like I get very upset actually when people, you know, say like if people go off because of taivas or because they were abused. And although, you know, for sure there are people who have that. You know, there are definitely, I've known quite a number of people who want, you know, who liked From Life, who are successful in From Life, who it's going to cost them to leave From Life, and yet they want to stay, and yet intellectually they can't do it. In other words, you know, I do believe that could be a very, very big part of a person's experience. Right. But, you know, all I'm saying is that even for a person like that, and again, you know, some of the other moderators in the From OTD, you know, dialogue group are certainly, you know, fall into this category. Again, there's still, you know, no matter how intellectual you're not a robot. And again, you know, and again, there's conscious and there's subconscious things. And again, we can never know our own motives. In other words, you know, again, like even when we tell our story, you know, again, we paint it for all sorts of reasons and all sorts of things. And again, you know, yeah, people can say to me, you know, Bezos, you wanted to believe, you want to be able to keep on teaching, you want it. Yeah, I don't know. It doesn't bother me. And I'm certainly not leveling any accusation against someone who really just lost their faith. I know people like that. It's heartbreaking. It's really, you know, I feel for them very, very strongly. I don't judge them. I continue to be friends with people like that. But again, I just don't, you know, I mostly stay away from like the real debate stuff, because it's just so not where I'm at right now. In other words, again, like that's the thing. Like, I'm not trying to win any arguments. I just want to serve the Ribbono Shalom. I want to bring God into every, you know, aspect of my being, every part of the world that I can.
Right. I feel the same. I used to get into arguments mostly because I thought it was fun, though. I don't think I was really a big trying to convince people, but I thought it was fun. Who did I convince? I don't know. Right. Like,
right. No, right.
And how open was I to their arguments? Who knows?
Yeah. I mean, sometimes I get told, you know, that I'm doing, you know, curative or something like that. And it's a little bit of a scary word for me. I mean, curative to me is like trying to like save somebody. And I'm not trying to save anybody. I don't, you know, go out on the streets and try to find them. But if someone comes to me and wants to talk about it, look, that's the thing. As someone who really, again, my, you know, my, my relationship with God is you know, is incredibly important to me. And I really do believe that the reason why I went through all those really difficult years is so that I could help other people. But that's one of the reasons I'm so open about what I went through, is because I feel like, you know, God put me through that so that I could help people. But again, you know, I'm not looking for people. I'm not trying to convince anyone. I'm not trying. But if you come to me and you say, look, you know, how do you do it? What worked for you? I'm having a hard time. I'll speak to you. And again, I'm not going to try to convince you. I'm not trying to win points or anything like that. I understand, you know, I don't have any slam dunk proofs. I'm not trying to, you know, pull you over to my side. But if something in my experience can be helpful to another person, then I feel obligated to try to be there, you know, but not in, you know, I'm not a member of a curative organization. I'm not, you know, I'm just someone who's, again, I'm trying to be a serious Eved Hashem. I'm trying to be a good husband, which is, you know, much harder than a lot of the things. I'm trying to be a good father, but you know, I want to help people who want to be, you know, who are looking for help. I'm not trying to save anybody.
Well, we're running up to our end. This is exactly when I wanted to talk to you, because I do think you are one of the people that I know that is just honest about their own struggles and just honest about like how he sees reality without any of the apologetic tricks we sometimes see. All sides, everywhere. So, Rabbi, I want to thank you very much. Do you have a final thing to say?
Yeah, I think so. But again, I think that, you know, people, it's much more comforting to live in a place where everything feels safe and everything feels known, where the ground is firm beneath your feet. But I just think, you know, look, think about the time that we're living in. We're living in, you know, the time of COVID. And one of the things that, you know, I'd say a religious person who really lives it, you know, the more you think about it, the more you realize you never really had control, that you're not, you know, things that, but even people who thought they had control, who thought that they knew the way the world works, all of a sudden, you know, I mean, you know, pandemics, that was a thing of, you know, the distant past. We were past that. We're, you know, science and all this stuff. And I just think we have to recognize that, you know, this is a complicated world we're in, and to not get locked into, you know, trying to debate or trying to win, or just I'm on a certain team and therefore I'm going to, you know, fight it, you know, for that team at all expenses, but to be open to where life takes you, to speak to interesting people, to learn to respect people with different beliefs, to learn to be okay with people who are not like you. And again, just to realize there are a lot of interesting people out there. I mean, there's so many, you know, there are deep thinkers, there are deep believers. There's so much great stuff out there. Speak to people. And you know, again, just, you know, be honest with yourself. You know, as you said, like, it's not about debates. It's not about trying to win. It's not about trying to save anybody. It's about trying to make sense of this crazy thing that we call life. And, you know, none of us gets out of here alive, and none of us gets out of here knowing whether what we chose was correct or not. But, you know, that's the reality we're in. And if you kind of accept that, you know, you'll get somewhere interesting.
Right. Thank you so much for coming on my podcast.
Thank you for having me. I've enjoyed the conversation very much.
Okay. And for everyone else, remember the name Hillel Zeitlin. Go Google him right now. And I will be back soon with the next episode.